the changes in the banking industry affected you? With the looming possibility that your local bank branch might disappear and more web, mobile, and social technologies, what will the changes mean for you and your business? Welcome to Breaking Banks with your host, Brett King. The possibility that banking is no longer a place you go, but just something that you do, has become very real. Now, here is Brett King.
Welcome to Breaking Banks. We are coming to you from New York today. We have snow on the ground. It was we didn't get snow for Christmas this year. It was a bit disappointing, wasn't it, Rachel? Yeah, she's not disappointed. She Rachel doesn't like the cold weather, though she spent it in Christmas in Utah with the family where it was snow there, right?
Yeah.
So this is the first show for 2015. Welcome back to Breaking Banks. We had a great show to close out the year with Robert Scobel and Osama Bedia, and we have Mike Walsh coming up. You guys would have heard it from him back in July. Mike gave a great interview there. We'll speak to him shortly. But before that, if you've been watching the news, there's been a lot of predictions on 2015. I would direct your attention to Jim Morales from the Financial Brand. He did a great sort of crowdsourcing of what's going to be hot in 2015. I think he sort of crowdsourced like 60 fintech experts from all around the world. Jim's become a phenomenal curator as well as the guest host of Breaking Banks from time to time. So check out his piece. Claire Cockerton from Invest Finance, she had some predictions about 2015. Who else? There was American Banker did that. There's a bunch of predictions. Everyone sort of seems to be very focused on what happened at the end of 2014 and what's going to happen this year. We've got CES this week, of course, with a lot of announcements. Did you see the Mercedes self-driving car concept? That was very interesting. A lot of really interesting stuff happening at the moment. 2015 is going to be a huge year for fintech. And coming out of the gate, you guys might have seen that Moovin, actually, we announced our launch of our smartwatch app this year. So this year. It was this year, but just a couple of days ago. And so, Alex, I've invited Alex Sion, who's my co-founder and the president at Moovin, to join us, and because there's been a lot of interest in that. And just give you guys a bit of background. Alex Sion, welcome back to Breaking Banks.
Thanks, Brett. Thanks for having me.
So the smartwatch, why a smartwatch?
Yeah, no, I think, long story short, Moovin in this latest release has enabled our core receipt, real-time receipt functionality to be accessible on both the Samsung and the Motorola smartwatches. And to us, it was really kind of less about smartwatches themselves and more about what we saw as a completely logical, perfect extension of the core Moovin experience, which is about providing customers with the right information in an easily accessible way that will ultimately change their financial behaviors. And we think that the smartwatch form factor is perfect for that.
So, it's not just a translation of the mobile app and putting it on a smartphone, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. So, we see smartwatches as a very distinct experience platform, right? And in many ways, the smartwatch versus the smartphone, smartwatch being on your wrist and the smartphone being something you put in your pocket, seemed like a logical place for us to really impact people's everyday financial behaviors. So if you think about the experience of buying something and receiving that real-time feedback on your behavioral patterns, the ability for that to show up on a watch versus a phone that you got to dig out of your pocket seemed like a really intuitive and perfect way for us to manifest the Moovin experience.
So this is really diverging sort of pretty significantly from the concept of PFM now, isn't it?
Yes.
Because PFM was more about, here's a summary of your transactions and what you've done. This is definitely sounds more, in the video that Moovin produced to promote this, how's it been positioned?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think we take a lot of inspiration and use a lot of metaphors to the health space, for example. And just like in the health space where, it's been proven now that the popularity of trackers on your wrist versus, you know, somebody trying to get healthy by engaging a personal trainer, right? We would consider the analogy of kind of a personal trainer the same as financial budgeting. Good thing to do, only a small percentage of people to do it.
Actually do
right? But then if you kind of slap a Fitbit wrist on your wrist or a Nike Fuel band, just like a smartwatch today, we think that's a perfect way to get that pure consciousness of your financial activities that'll ultimately change your behaviors for the better. So that's kind of the way we look at budgeting versus kind of what we're doing.
So in the VentureBeat article where we you know the app was launched, the reporter there, she said it was anti-budgeting. So yep. budgeting you don't think is going to be the way moving forward for financial health and financial wellness?
Yeah, absolutely. We've never thought that. So in many ways, Moovin was designed from the get-go to be the anti-budgeting tool, right? Much more focused on raising your financial consciousness and through that changing your behaviors versus saying, you know, having to force you through a more disciplined process that frankly most people can't do. So again, that, you know, to us, the future of things like smartwatches are going to be that contextual bits of information that influence spot decision making on the fly, and that's really not what budgeting is about. Budgeting is all about planning and more detailed stuff. So we don't really see any budgeting functions really being applicable for something like a smartwatch.
So it's still pretty early days. We don't have a lot of feedback yet on how many people have downloaded it. I guess we'll see that in over the coming weeks. But what do you hope to learn out of this process?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Like I said, I think we don't even know the installed user base of smartwatches out there today. To us, it was really about getting an experience out there that we felt was perfect for what Moovin was all about. And we definitely expect to learn a lot about that behavioral piece, right? Like, are people going to be able to reference their watch easier than their phone, perhaps? When it comes to receiving that real-time feedback, and is that a better behavior to maintain that financial consciousness and change the way you act?
Interesting. And what about with the relationship the Moovin now has with TD in Canada and Westpac in New Zealand? You know, is this a cycle that we're going to see repeated now where Moovin tries something in the US and then exports that to the global partners?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the really exciting piece, is our ability through our bank partners around the world, and many, many more coming, to reach millions of consumers around the world with the same consistent experience. In many ways, what Moovin's enabling is the ability for banks in this age where a lot of them are losing their face to the customer, you know, being having to compete with Apple and Google, who are launching their own wallets, that Moovin can provide a logical and really compelling face for banks around the world, and that's going to be centered around that ability to change financial behaviors.
Fantastic. So what else is going to happen for Moovin in 2015?
To 2015 is about global domination. It's going to be a lot of fun, exactly.
Okay, so we'll be hearing more about that. Alex Sion, the president and co-founder of Moovin, thanks for joining us on Breaking Banks today.
Thanks, Brett.
We'll see you again when you get another announcement.
Absolutely.
Thank you. So Moovin Smartwatch, you can check out the VentureBeat article on it, and also go to Moovin TV, the Moovin YouTube channel, and you can check out the little piece on financial wellness and financial health that we put up there. Okay. So at this point, I'd like to welcome Mike Walsh back to the show. Some of you will recall Mike was on the show, when was it, back in July, Rachel? Yeah. And he spoke about his book Futuretainment and some of the work he was doing around the world, touring, and some of the sort of looking at the anthropology, the way humans behave and the way certain societies, certain emerging markets were changing. It was a very interesting discussion. But he's back because Mike has just launched a new book. It's called The Dictionary of Dangerous Ideas. I think he published it himself, didn't you, Mike?
I did. The actual book was designed to be a dangerous idea.
There you go. So that's great. And this is actually interesting. There's a few. Seth Godin tried this, and Guy Kawasaki now has a publishing platform. And so, it's great to see this. You took some time off during the year, and you put this together. And for those of you that haven't read the book, it's a collection of, I think it's 88 of the most dangerous ideas that will impact, humanity over the next, the next few years, 20 years, 30 years out. Mike, tell us a little bit more about how you came to the idea for the book, and give us a little bit more depth on the book.
Thanks, Ray. It's a very different kind of book. I mean, when you pick it up, if you've got the hard copy, if you drop it hard enough.
I've got the Kindle version.
Well, see, if you've got the hard copy, if you put it on your coffee table, it may actually shatter it. It's that thick and heavy. Okay. But, you know, most business books are self-contained volumes. They're about one idea. And what I want to do with this book is really to provide a launching point for people to then go and discover new ideas. If you work in a company or an industry, it's very easy to be, caught up in the vacuum chamber of what people are talking about in your space. So this is designed to give busy executives a feel for some of the, the most interesting new technologies and debates that are happening more broadly across society and through the world.
So you start off the interviews, or you start off the story with a bit of history of dangerous ideas. You introduced two characters in particular. The first was Galileo and then Tesla. So what about Galileo made his ideas particularly dangerous? I think we all know the answer to it, but let me give you the articulation.
Well, you know, we often don't think of the most dangerous people being scientists. These seem to be, unless they're the mad scientist category.
Yes.
We don't think of the kind of the humble people in the white jackets and doing research being people who could be capable of changing the world. But when you look at the history of the biggest shifts and the transformations in the world that we've grown up in, they generally have their origins in an enabling technology, a new discovery in science, or a new way of looking at the world. So when you look at Tesla, Edison, Turing, Galileo, these were often people who started off not with the intention of disrupting society. They just really
an interesting idea.
An interesting idea.
And
what makes an idea dangerous is curious. Often technology is the catalyst, but primarily the dangerous part of the idea is that it challenges people who are in power or have existing market share.
Yeah.
And even deeper than that, it tends to engage with fundamental ideas of the human experience. When we were talking earlier, Brett, we were talking about the rise of Uber. And it seems in 2015 it's all about how do we become the Uber of X. And this is not very useful thinking, because what made Uber dangerous is not that it wanted to become a platform per se. They were solving a very specific, very human problem of difficult transportation. So for people in the fintech space, I think if you want to be a dangerous thinker, you've got to also start from first principles. You've got to look at the very human ideas of, wealth, money, the exchange of value, and ask, how can we reconsider these now in the context of a world where we're all, in a sense, addressable with our mobile phones?
So that's interesting you talk about first principles. That's something that Elon Musk seems to be really hot on at the moment. Would you categorize him as one of the dangerous ideators?
Absolutely. I think he's probably the poster child for dangerous thinking. One of the most amazing things he did last year was actually go to his wall of all the patents that they've been awarded and take the decision to actually open source them. Because what he realized was that the traditional model was people coming up with scientific innovations and trying to patent them. But in order for him to really create an industry and an ecosystem, he had to get more people involved.
So, you talk about the fact that sometimes these ideas take us off in different directions. We've often said that, the big idea, the internet, was the big disruptive play. Are you saying that really the internet's enabled new dangerous ideas, or I'd be interested in your thoughts about where that sits in the ecosystem?
I guess so. In a way, what you're asking is why now?
Yeah.
And I think we're about to enter an entirely new era of invention and creativity, which in many ways parallels what we saw at the end of the 19th century with the rise of electrification. And what we're seeing is innovation shifting to individuals rather than big corporations. That's because the tools of creating amazing stuff now are now easily and readily available to anyone. And more than that, the entire world is now becoming programmable. I'm not just talking about the Internet of Things here, but almost every aspect of reality, whether it's our bodies, biology, even matter with nanomaterials, are becoming addressable with programming language. And they're all reducible now to a common language of data. So if you have an expertise in programming software, you can probably understand a little bit with some translation about how DNA and genomics might work. In fact, even in genomics and the whole field of biohacking, you're getting code libraries now of proteins. Wow. So many of the ideas in software programming now are appearing in other areas and other industries. So that's why I think we're about to enter this explosive and incredibly innovative time where the thinking and the innovations and the disruptive approaches from one sector will very quickly spread to others.
So one of the things I like about your disruptive ideas, you talk about big data and algorithms, artificial intelligence. I like the fact that at the end of each chapter you ask a question. Why the question?
Well, what I tried to do is for each of these ideas is in a single page capture the essence of what it was about, why you should care, and what the latest research is on it. But that's not enough. If you're really going to make it your own, you've got to, in a way, think about why it's relevant to you. So at the end of each chapter, I've given what I call a mind grenade or a simple question that prompts further notice. So one of the ones I think is relevant to your audience is the blockchain. So the question I asked.
I want to get into the blockchain, but we're coming up to a break, Mike. So why don't we do this? Why don't we have a quick break, and then let's talk about the dangerous ideas in fintech after the break. How does that sound?
Let's do it.
Great. You're with Brett King on Breaking Banks. We have Mike Walsh, the author of The Dictionary of Dangerous Ideas, on. We'll be right back after this break.
When you're looking for the right place to eat, there's an app for that. When you need directions getting there, there's an app for that. And if you're trying to make a healthy choice, there's an app for that. But what about an app that tells you how you're doing with your money? Now, there's an app for that. It's called Moovin, a free app and debit account that automatically tracks your spending. You get real-time feedback with every purchase you make and a debit account with no overdraft or monthly fees. So if you want to stay on track with your money, download the Moovin app for free on iPhone or Android and check out Moovin.com. That's Moovin.com.
Your bank's customers expect comprehensive, convenient, and consistent service when and where they need it. A mobile app is a great start, but with so many devices and operating systems out there, it can be hard to keep up with demand. That's why today's leading banks count on the Kony Multichannel Experience Cloud. With Kony, you can design, develop, and manage multi-channel apps from one integrated platform. Build an app once, and with one click, you can deploy it securely across all digital channels, phones, tablets, desktop, and more. That means more efficient for you and a better experience for your customers. Want to get to market fast? Explore Kony's range of ready-to-run apps, including retail, commercial, and private banking. With features like person-to-person transfers, targeted campaigns, built-in integrations, and cutting-edge compliance, Kony apps provide the framework and flexibility you need to rise above the competition. Go beyond first-generation mobile banking. Visit kony.com/BK to launch your multi-channel strategy. That's KONY.com/BK.
Today, make that long overdue call to your bank and thank them. Thank them for a checking account, one that has a minimum balance and penalties for going below it. Thank them for a savings account, one that has almost no interest and charges statement fees to let you know it. Most of all, thank them for overdraft fees and all those other fees you never even knew existed. Thank them today. Why? Because the future of banking is here, and it's not just what you want, it's what you deserve. Moovin is a free app and debit card with no overdraft, ATM, or monthly fees. Best of all, you get an instant receipt every time you make a purchase, and daily feedback on your spending so you can always be on top of your money. So make that call to your bank and say thanks, but no thanks. And when you're done, download the free app and get Moovin today.
The successful businesses of today do everything they can to meet the needs of their customers. But outdated IT systems mean that banks often struggle to offer the same level of personalized service. SunTech is working with some of the world's leading banks to help them provide the products, offers, and services that their customers need and want. Visit SunTechGroup.com to find out more. That's SunTechGroup.com.
from the boardroom to you. Voice America Business Network.
You are listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or send an email to breakingbanksradio@gmail.com. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to Breaking Banks. We're coming to you from New York. The snow is on the ground. Winter is finally here. Before the break, we were talking with Mike Walsh, the author of The Dictionary of Dangerous Ideas. Mike, where can people find out more information on the book?
You can buy it on Amazon or you can visit my webpage, mike-walsh.com.
Mike-walsh.com. Is it a hyphen or a dash?
Semantics. Semiotics.
True. So before the break, we were about to start discussing the dangerous ideas in fintech, and you talked about the blockchain. It's very interesting, isn't it? Because people like Mark Andreessen and others have come up and they make a big deal about the blockchain being sort of reinventing or rebooting banking. So what is it about some of these technologies that could really fundamentally take the banking system in a different direction? Because it really hasn't changed for a few hundred years.
No, I think that's true. And there's a few angles on this. I mean, when you take something like the blockchain, I think Mark is right. Its real lasting impact is potentially has nothing to do with finance at all. I mean, to me, the lesson of blockchain is, can we imagine a world without intermediaries? And if we can, what are other industries that might be disrupted by replacing intermediaries with a distributed transaction record? So, you know, for me, a lot of these dangerous ideas touch not just the place where they originate. They touch broader questions of how can society be reshaped if we really assimilate what that concept means.
So when it comes to sort of the impact of this, you know, how do organizations traditionally or incumbents traditionally face off against these dangerous ideas? Historically, does it tend to be messy?
Well, there's kind of big established corporations tend to have two modes, either denial or co-option. So they'll either try to pretend, and you know, I worked in the newspapers for a long time, so I had first-hand experience of this. They try to deny for as long as possible that there is actually something different happening elsewhere.
I didn't know you were. Which newspaper did you work?
I worked for the Murdoch Group for many years, actually doing strategy.
Oh, right. Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah, and you know when I joined, they said, "We assume you want to work with the digital assets." I said, "No, I want to work in print and television," because having worked in the first internet boom, I'd had a very close eye on how the internet worked, but I wanted to understand how big media worked.
Right.
And I can tell you, you know, for many of those years, as it applied to key categories like classifieds, there was a total state of denial about what the risks to their business were. But then often corporations will spin around into the second stage of co-option, where they'll try to either buy, coerce, or dominate.
Or acquire.
Yeah, or acquire.
I'm hoping it's
acquire. As opposed to dominate.
Yeah.
And then it's interesting because a lot of the companies they then buy, the corporate antibodies of the parent are much stronger than the new virus. So they tend to overwhelm the innovation. Yeah.
So you know, we talk about the 100 million club in fintech. You've got I've got to see if I can remember it now. BBVA, Santander, Spurbank, HSBC, and who's the other one? Do you remember? Yeah, Rachel's nodding her head, shaking her head. No, there's one other, and I'm going to be raked over the coals for not remembering that. But so the 100 million club is sort of putting these investment funds together, sort of venture capital arms, but they're doing some incubation labs and things like that. Is that that sort of co-opting approach that you're talking about?
Yeah, and it's the risk is that it becomes a petting zoo for innovation. You know, you bring some entrepreneurs and some, you know, cool startups around, and you feel like you're breaking the model.
But the big ship is still sailing.
Well, I think what tends to happen with kind of corporate innovation funds is that they tend to attract, or they tend to fund ideas that will incrementally improve their existing model, or are a kind of an outsourced IT department. They don't necessarily ones that truly challenge and break their model. I mean, you can imagine if Kodak had set up an innovation fund in the 70s and someone had brought a digital camera, whether they would have actually funded it.
Yeah.
So, you know, when I look at big companies, I think there's really two sources of inspiration of where you can get close to the change that that is truly dangerous. One is consumers, human life. The daily things we do, even beyond banking, about the way we communicate, the way we think about value, the way we buy things. This is why payments are so big, because they're so close to that fundamental human experience of what we do on a daily basis. Mm. But the second area of where I think innovation comes from is something that's often overlooked, which is how do we work? And, you know, in 2015, some of the most fundamental principles about the way organizations are structured, even the idea of the company, is going to come under challenge. More and more, I guess, enterprise functions are being automated by software. More people are trying to think about, you know, how do we design an office more effectively? How do we allow freelancers to become part of our organization? What is the best way to manage people? So although this sounds like HR, the truth is that companies that are able to tap into the dangerous ideas and dangerous thinkers within their organization are going to outperform those that can't.
Right. Now, during the break, when we were off air just talking, you mentioned the tendency of people to take models like Uber and try and duplicate it, but that's missing the point. Do you want to sort of go over that with the crowd, the Uberization of business?
Yeah, I sometimes think that venture startups can be a bit like memes, a combination of memes and Hollywood, because, you know, just like Hollywood, VCs often think about things in high concept. So, you know, in the way you might have this movie is going to be Terminator meets The Notebook. People pitch ideas saying this is going to be Uber meets Snapchat. And you get these ridiculous ideas then as a consequence. Companies that are truly disruptive always start from first principles. They start by tackling a true problem that exists or something that touches the human condition. So that's the danger a lot of these copycat, meme-based startups now that are trying to become the Uber of their own space.
So how was Uber a dangerous idea?
Well, Uber was a dangerous idea because it tackled a very big and very real problem for many people, which is how do you find reliable transport in a world where the taxi system is broken? Mm. Interestingly, in other markets where Uber's had trouble breaking into, say, Colombia, you know, in Colombia, the problem was how do you take a taxi and actually arrive at your destination? Okay. they had actually developed a very effective coordination mobile app long before Uber, which to this day is still very effective.
So, what's it called?
I think it's actually called Taxi.
Okay, yeah.
So it's a very successful...
That's a good name for an app.
I think it's spelled differently, though. so, you know, when you look, at, I think, in fintech, it's always worth taking as inspiration other markets where they've started to look at this question of value in new ways. I know you've taken a close look at Southeast Asia before in your own research.
Yeah, we talk a lot about M-Pesa here, and, of course, Philippines.
And the Philippines.
Smart, yeah.
And you know, the interesting thing about the Philippines, of course, is not that they're doing mobile transactions. It's that by trading airtime as currency, they've actually developed a different concept of value. So a journalist actually in the Philippines told me recently that there's this bizarre trend that, you know, men who've got their mistresses, you know, they go now at lunchtime, they go, I've got to go pay my airtime. And what they mean is that, like, they're all their mistresses now, they basically give them airtime as a form of payment, which is quite bizarre, but it shows you that where technology intersects with culture.
Alex was just in Philippines. I'll have to ask him about that. Whether he used it.
See, sorry, Alex. When people start using MOVEN for ways you don't expect or aren't prepared for, that's when you've really, really become a cultural phenomenon.
Yeah, you've been dangerous. Well, you heard our smartwatch app. So when we look at these disruptive innovations that are taking place around the world, and you spoke about genomics, and you spoke about artificial intelligence, things like that. In the banking industry, we're still there's much of the banking industry that is really hooked on advice. But we see the emergence of robo-advisors. We've seen high-frequency trading, dark pools, using algorithms now to trade more efficiently than human traders. Where do you think the opportunity for disruption, I know we're sort of getting away from dangerous, but disruption is sort of this hot term that we use now to describe all this stuff. What is the dangerous idea when it comes to the interface between financial services? There's a lot of human elements in banking. We got compliance officers, risk officers, lending officers, tellers, and financial advisors.
Yeah.
Is that a dangerous idea that these people may no longer be needed?
Well, I think in a time where artificial intelligence and algorithms are becoming more sophisticated, we have to ask the very real question about what are machines good at and what are people good at. There's a false assumption in the banking industry that people certainly of a certain age will prefer human beings because that's good service. And you see a lot of private banks are organized along that principle. But if you talk to someone in the new generation, if they have to deal with a human being, that's a sign that the platform is broken down.
Right. Yeah. So I'm sorry, you can't do that. You've got to come and see a human. It's like, well, that's not actually, I just want it fixed.
Yeah, yeah. Or it should just work anyway. I mean, can you imagine Facebook if you had to call in on an IVR system?
Every time you wanted to do a status update.
Exactly, and tell people how you felt. So it wouldn't work. And I think it sounds ludicrous, but actually I think a lot of the next generation look at banks and go, this is the same thing.
It's ludicrous.
It makes no sense. Yeah. And so I think large components of the banking platform, and this is not just for the basic functions, I mean even like higher-end wealth management, should actually work and reconfigure itself based on your behavior and based on your data. I mean, that's really a given. It's what the next generation have grown up to expect. But that isn't to say that humans aren't important. The more you automate core transactional elements, the more that human beings can elevate what they do.
Right.
So not only can they be more strategic, in terms of the interface with customers, they can help manage the complexity. And it's curious, when you look at financial advisors, last year I was a keynote speaker for the Million Dollar Roundtable.
Yep.
And, I'd done a lot of research on advisors in the UK. And what amazed me was that, they'd gone independent very early on in the market. So the ones that were there had to survive.
Right.
And they did that by becoming a bridge between the technology and the platforms and the customers. So they were helping people navigate the complexity.
Reducing the complexity.
Exactly. And I think you'll see that more in banks. You'll see more teams of very smart, very connected individuals who help really help customers navigate the complexity of the bank and solve when the data algorithms get it wrong.
So that's interesting. You talked about in the book, one of your dangerous ideas was data profiling.
Yeah.
So what could go wrong with data profiling?
Well, it's a very kind of Kafka kind of scenario where essentially the algorithms get too smart. It's kind of a tyranny of data. And that's, when the system decides that you belong in a category and you don't, it's often very difficult on these platforms to let the company know that they've made a mistake.
Can you give me an example?
Well, I'll give you an example that haunts me every time I travel, which is that for some reason, probably due to my travel patterns or I've been to Saudi Arabia, I'm on some kind of watch list, which means I get four S's on my boarding passes, which means I get a wonderful private search experience.
Yeah, I've had
that. And
When I'm traveling on my own.
That's right. And when I talked to the TSA about it, I got one of these wonderful letters saying we can neither confirm nor deny that you're on a watch list.
Yes.
But then someone told me privately it could just be your surname. And, being called Mike Walsh, there's certainly a lot of Mike Walsh's Irish in the world. It's not very difficult to end up on a watch list. And that's a perfect example of a kind of a data profiled scenario where you've got a security system which on aggregate works quite effectively, but for an individual can be totalitarian.
Yeah. Listen, we've got a couple of minutes before we finish up and go to the break, Mike. So first of all, to sort of summarize, I know this, you probably get asked this, but what's the most dangerous idea that you have in the book?
In some ways, I think the most dangerous idea is the idea I started with, which is A is for A-B testing. And I say that because as leaders, business leaders, we're taught to come up with a strategy, to come up with long-term plans. But I think if you really believe in the lessons of the 21st century, it's that you don't need a strategy. You just need to know how to run an experiment. And that's why this is the first dangerous idea for me, is that, you know, if you want to really think dangerously and create disruptive ideas in businesses, you've got to be open to the fact that whatever you do first or think first is probably going to be wrong.
Okay, so, you know, as we've got a little, just a little bit of time left before the break, tell us how people can find the Dictionary of Dangerous Ideas, where they can get it from.
Well, you can buy it for your Kindle. It's in electronic format on Amazon. You can also buy a soft copy there. If you'd like a beautiful hard copy, which is a coffee table destroyer, you can visit my website, www.mike-walsh.com, and there's a link to buy the book there.
Great. And people can follow you on Twitter and Facebook also, right?
Yeah, it's at Mike Walsh.
Now, you also have a great video trailer of the book with the dangerous ideas.
Yes.
Where can we find that?
If you go onto YouTube.
Just search on the Dictionary of Dangerous Ideas.
Or go to youtube.com/Michael Walsh. Okay. I had an amazing team of animators put together a summary of the book in 2 minutes. So if you're post-literate, you can just watch the video.
So what's next for you for the rest of the year?
No rest for the wicked. Like you, I'm going to be speaking a lot throughout the world and probably working on my next book.
Well, it'll be great to hear. You know, it's 5 years between this one. I hope we don't have to wait 5 years for the next one.
You know, I wrote this book in 4 weeks, but I spent 5 years thinking about it. So I think that's a very inefficient model.
Absolutely. Well, hopefully you and I can catch up to somewhere on the road, probably in a foreign country.
I'm looking forward to it.
Great. You've been listening to Mike Walsh. He is the author of Futuretainment and his latest book, The Dictionary of Dangerous Ideas. Check it out on Amazon.com or go to Mike-Walsh.com and check it out there. Also check out the video on YouTube. Mike Walsh, thanks for joining us on Breaking Banks today.
My pleasure. Thanks, Greg.
See ya.
Today, make that long overdue call to your bank and thank them. Thank them for a checking account, one that has a minimum balance and penalties for going below it. Thank them for a savings account, one that has almost no interest and charges statement fees to let you know it. Most of all, thank them for overdraft fees and all those other fees you never even knew existed. Thank them today. Why? Because the future of banking is here, and it's not just what you want, it's what you deserve. Moovin is a free app and debit card with no overdraft, ATM, or monthly fees. Best of all, you get an instant receipt every time you make a purchase, and daily feedback on your spending so you can always be on top of your money. So make that call to your bank and say thanks, but no thanks. And when you're done, download the free app and get Moovin today.
The successful businesses of today do everything they can to meet the needs of their customers. But outdated IT systems mean that banks often struggle to offer the same level of personalized service. SunTech is working with some of the world's leading banks to help them provide the products, offers, and services that their customers need and want. Visit suntechgroup.com to find out more. That's suntechgroup.com.
Your bank's customers expect comprehensive, convenient, and consistent service when and where they need it. A mobile app is a great start, but with so many devices and operating systems out there, it can be hard to keep up with demand. That's why today's leading banks count on the Kony Multichannel Experience Cloud. With Kony, you can design, develop, and manage multi-channel apps from one integrated platform, Build an app once, and with one click, you can deploy it securely across all digital channels, phones, tablets, desktop, and more. That means more efficiency for you and a better experience for your customers. Want to get to market fast? Explore Kony's range of ready-to-run apps, including retail, commercial, and private banking, with features like person-to-person transfers, targeted campaigns, built-in integrations, and cutting-edge compliance. Kony apps provide the framework and flexibility you need to rise above the competition. Go beyond first-generation mobile banking. Visit Kony.com/BK to launch your multi-channel strategy. That's KONY.com/BK.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
You are listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or send an email to breakingbanksradio@gmail.com. Now, back to the program.
So welcome back to Breaking Banks. Thanks, Mike, for once again a very interesting coverage of some sort of longer-term thinking. Now, whenever we talk about future thinking in banking, then we have to include a regular guest on our show, Chris Skinner. Welcome back to Breaking Banks.
Hey, Brett. How are you doing? Happy New Year.
And to you. Did you go have a break?
Oh, yeah. I went back to the 1930s, but I always look at the future from the past, so don't I
you,
have to do
I
that.
I thought you live in the 1930s.
No. Actually, I'm in the 2030s, but...
2030s. Yeah. We always have this discussion, don't we? I'm 5 years ahead and you're 20 years ahead, right?
I'm a flapper. You're a slapper. I'm not going there.
Thank you. Okay. Chris, before the show, you heard, Alex talking about the smartwatch launch, and we were talking about that during the break, and, there's a lot of gadgets coming out right now at CES, the new LG Flex and robotics and TVs and smart fridges and the Mercedes smart car and things like that. So there's a lot of shiny new stuff that banks are getting all excited about. What do you think are the challenges going to be this year in terms of, as more devices come into the fray and more experiences are pushed on customers, have we got some fundamental things we've got to fix first, or do you think that the banking industry, with the build-up in 2014, is finally ready to sort of jump on this engagement bandwagon?
Well, there's a lot of interesting stuff at the front end, wearables, the Internet of Things, the idea that you can push devices into ubiquity. And that's important. I'm not denying that's important. But for most banks, they are not yet ready to engage with customers in a digital front end. And what most banks are doing is putting in the icing on the cake, without actually addressing the ingredients of the cake, the core of what is the recipe they're trying to cook. And if you look at the recipe that they should be trying to cook, it's a digital core. And that's where I come from as my fundamental, saying if you don't address the back end, the fundamental digital core, then you're not going to be able to provide the froth and the icing on the cake. All you're going to be doing is providing something that's a whipped cream that disappears in 5 minutes. It's not going to be there for the next 5 years. So you really have to deal with the back end, the fundamentals, the digital core of the bank, and renew your core systems. And most banks aren't prepared to deal with that big pill to swallow, because it's too big a pill to swallow. But some are doing it, some are changing. And what it really means is that you've got to evolve from the old systems that are there, that we all call legacy, heritage, COBOL, Fortran, Pascal, whatever you want to call it, into cloud-based, component-based, IP-enabled, modular systems. And that's where most banks are really being challenged, and some are really taking that challenge at their heart this year. And in fact, that's where I think the biggest focus will be for most of the incumbent banks.
Okay, so let's sort of be specific. Can you talk about a specific experience where a 1970s core won't be able to make the transition when it comes to customer experience? Could you be specific?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was with a bank just yesterday, and they said, well, we've got a mortgage system that's from the 1980s, and it's okay because mortgages are 25 years, and you know, we're going to process those and keep those customers and they're on those systems and we don't need to change them. And in many ways, I agree with them because that is not a 24/7 real-time system. But where you do have payments, deposit accounts, regular customer frequent contact that's 24/7 that should be in real time in the 21st century, if that's in batch overnight updates, you're screwed basically because you're not dealing with the customer in the way that they have to be dealt with today. You need to have that in a digital structure that's cloud IP enabled, internet enabled. And if you're not there, then you are dead because the customer's going to be there in real time. And if you're not there in real time, then you're not there.
So, you know, we're seeing a lot of, you know, talk about the Internet of Things. And one of the things about the Internet of Things, I got to tie myself up a knot with that, is, you know, this world of sensors collecting new data. So part of the challenge here, I think, stop me if I'm going the wrong way with this, but you know, part of it is collecting the right information, and it's the fact that when you start thinking about real-time engagement and you start thinking about behavior and about inserting banking, you know, to do the most good, to provide a solution for a customer in the moment. I'm at a realtor looking at a home. Can I afford to buy it? I'm in a car dealership. I'm out shopping. Is there a better deal? Is there in-store financing? All of those things require context and require the ability to understand that environment. So it's part of the problem, a data problem as well, because that data is not being collected?
To a certain extent. I mean, where I'm coming from is saying that all of the Internet of Things, the wearables, is froth on the cake. It's irrelevant. It's just
I'm feeling hungry with all this talk of cake.
Yeah, it's just the glitzy stuff on the front end that's exciting, but it's not actually integral. And the integral piece is saying, do I get my customer? Do I understand their digital footprint? Can I leverage their digital footprint for better customer service, for reduced cost, for increased share of wallet? And if I can really do that, then I can have a competitive battleground where the data about my customer is something that I can leverage to beat the others. And so the first thing you have to do is to look at your core system. Is it in real time? Is it digital? Is it capable of competing? Once you've done that, is it agile? Is it flexible? Is it in the cloud? Is it capable of keeping up with new customer requirements like the Internet of Things? Once you've done that, is it actually leveraging the data? Is it using the customer data? Is it competing in an informative way against your competition with that data? And if you're really doing all those things well, then yeah, you're really actually at the forefront of your business in a financial digital context. If you're not doing any of those things, if you're still in legacy, if you're still not renewing your core systems, if you're not in the cloud, if you're not doing data analytics, then you might as well give up because, to be honest, you're not there. You're not in the 21st century.
So one bank that you've been consistently bullish on is mBank in Poland. Mm-hmm. So if you were to compare, say, someone with mBank who's got a new core and has built this, compared with a traditional bank who doesn't have real-time systems, then what's your view in terms of the advantage that they would have in respect to, the engagement model?
Well, I'm bullish not just on them. I'm, you know, Fedor Bank, which is now launching in America in a joint venture. Movin, with your own institution.
Thank you.
Deniz Bank in Turkey, ICICI Bank in India, Commonwealth Bank of Australia, all the banks I pick on, and Bank of America even, but Bank of America is, all the banks I pick on are the banks that are using technology to differentiate themselves to compete. And all of them, the thing that they're doing is saying, you know what, we're not in a branch-based culture. We're not in a culture that's based in the last century. We're not in a culture that inhibits us from the 21st century data disruption. We're going to embrace that disruption. We're going to incorporate that disruption. We're going to make it our advantage. So mBank, Fedor, Movin, ICICI, you know, all the banks, Deniz, they are Commonwealth Bank, they're all saying we have to make digital the core of our institution and how we distribute and engage with customers. And those banks, those institutions, those organizations that get that are the ones that I'm always coming back to just saying, you need to look at these guys because these are the guys that are shaping the future of financial services. The guys that are stuck in branch-based distribution, legacy systems, they're dead.
Yeah. Okay, so let's do come back to some of the predictions that have been floating around. You know, you're often asked to give some commentary on this. So, you know, what will be a core focus apart from some ongoing core system replacement and the glue between the interaction and the old systems, building a translation layer or messaging layer? You know, what do you think banks are going to be really rushing to focus on this year?
Most of them will be focused on incremental stuff around how to deal with moving core systems into the digital age, how to deal with cloud and private cloud incorporation, how to deal with data analytics, how to deal with incubation and then using the incubated businesses that are startups into the core businesses that are being disrupted. In the meantime, we have the stuff that you've talked about earlier, the Internet of Things and wearables, which I did say earlier is the end froth. But what's interesting there is that if you look at the Internet of Things, and in particular how that changes the core business of interaction, of value exchange, and how we deal with people walking around and suddenly their clothes, their cars, their houses, their windows, their ceilings can transact and do commerce and become intelligent agents of value exchange. If I'm honest, that becomes really interesting, but it's so futuristic that I don't talk about it much because you're looking at about 10 years away. Yeah. But the banks that really understand what's happening right now with digital disruption and core systems renewal will be the ones that are looking at the 10-year, 5-year space of saying, how can we use the Internet of Things to differentiate ourselves from a digital data analytics viewpoint, from a customer engagement viewpoint, from a competitive viewpoint, and do things where you don't even think about the friction of money, you know, like the Uber stuff. And everyone always comes back to Uber and saying, oh, isn't that cool? And Starbucks, isn't that cool? Yeah. We'll be saying, you know what? Yep. It's not even 10 years, it's 5 years. We're saying, there's a bank, wow, you know, they've done something where you don't even think about money, you just live, and suddenly things get paid for without you actually having to do usernames and passwords and think about it. That's really cool. I want to be that bank. But unfortunately, you didn't think about it today.
What about from a skill set perspective? You know, we heard this from Mike before, you know, in terms of the debate on this and you know, open office design, things like that. But did you see the discussion on Twitter the other day about, you know, who has a chief design officer or who has are you starting to see a change in metrics and organization chart around optimizing for engagement?
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you look at the CDO, Chief Design Officer, or CIO, Chief Innovation, or Chief Information, or Chief Ideas Officer, I mean, banks are really, both incumbents and new banks, trying to come up with cool names to attract talent. And the talent war is getting really interesting because, you know, JP Morgan, Jamie Dimon is trying to get the guys from Google and from Facebook to come and join a bank. And to a large extent, people are saying, you guys are really dull, aren't you? Well, why do I want to join a bank? But coders are the rock stars. So designers, yeah, coders, user experience guys, the guys who really understand how to engage the customer remotely, digitally, are becoming, yeah, the most valued assets that are in the talent war for not just financial institutions, but for technology institutions. And that's where the fintech stuff comes together, which you and I talk about a lot, because fintech is this new marketplace. Banking's dead. You know, yeah, we are in a marketplace called fintech. And it is the 21st century market.
It's blowing up in a good way. I mean, billions of dollars all around the world. Everyone's talking about it. Finally, we're relevant.
You blogged about it the other day, and you know, the billions of dollars. No one knows the numbers, but we know it's a lot. Yeah. And fintech is the hot space.
Absolutely. So that's cool. We become, you know, we can sort of mark out our claim as fintech rock stars again. So, what about you? I mean, we've got about a minute left. What's happening for Chris Skinner in 2015? Financial Services Club is growing. You know, but tell us a bit about what's on your schedule.
I got a whole lot of ideas, more of 2014 than before, which is build the FS Club, build Digital Bank as the book platform, and you know, emulate Mr. Brett King in terms of becoming someone who's on the circuit, being recognized as giving value and information.
No, you've already got there, my friend.
And
you've got more hair than me too, so.
I saw your photo. I might even Facebook and retweet it.
No,
that's a great photo. When Brett had hair, you got to see it, folks. It was a great photo.
Blonde,
but no, I'm kind of looking at FinTech 2015 plus, and where does Chris gonna fit into that? Because I've been there, I've done that, and people know me for that, and I kind of. I'm getting a name for it, which is maybe I'll build on. So watch that space.
I think you're doing great. And how many countries are you thinking you're going to do this year?
Oh, number one.
What, number one? You're going to do one country?
Sorry, I might have missed a question.
How many countries do you think you'll visit?
Oh, sorry. Sorry. As I said, what do I think my country will be? In Britain. Yeah, okay. Of course, Britain will be number one. London is number one fintech center of the world. I keep saying that.
Okay.
But number of countries I'll be in this year, about the same number as you, plus one.
Okay, cool. Rachel's.
I saw your numbers, by the way. Your numbers are very impressive.
Yeah, I need sleep. I need to sleep for a year, I think. All right, Chris. Look, it is fantastic to have you on. Look, I just feel like every time we have you on, it's not long enough. So hopefully we'll be able to find some time in your schedule to come back in a couple of weeks.
No worries, my friend.
Take care. Thank you, and have a great year. Well, that was the indomitable Chris Skinner, author of Digital Bank and all-round nice guy and commentator on FinTech. Right now, to close out the show, we have our old pal Ron Shevlin back for 2015 with his first moment of snark. Take it away, Ron.
Do you trust me? If you don't know me, you're probably thinking, I don't know you, so I don't know if I trust you or not. If you do know me, you might be thinking, well, I trust you in some areas. The point is that wasn't a simple question. When I asked you if you trusted me, you probably couldn't answer the question unconditionally. Funny how that all goes by the wayside when researchers ask consumers if they trust banks. A recent Harris poll found that credit unions and community banks are the most trusted institutions, with over 3/4 of Americans having some or a great deal of trust in them. Let's be clear about what's being reported here, though. Harris did not ask survey respondents to name their bank, categorize it as a community bank, credit union, or national bank, and say to what extent they trusted it. They presented respondents with a list of the types of financial institutions and asked them to what extent they trusted those categories. Now, when I asked you if you trusted me, you probably couldn't answer if you didn't know me. But somehow, despite not knowing more than just a handful of the nearly 14,000 community banks and credit unions in the country, survey respondents had no problem answering the trust question in the Harris survey. There's something else here that bugs me. What does it really mean to have some or a great deal of trust? Is your definition of a great deal of trust the same as mine? Is trust a bucket which we can accurately determine how filled it is? Of course not. But that doesn't stop credit union folks from going all Sally Field on us when they see the survey results. You know, they like us. They really like us. And it doesn't stop people from writing articles with titles like, How Big Data Can Build Trust in Banking. Really now? A poorly defined, intangible concept like big data can help banks build trust, which itself is intangible and immeasurable? So should we trust the trust numbers? I don't think so. Trust me. And that's been this week's Moment of Snark on Breaking Banks.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel. We'll explore more changes and challenges next week.